Now for Tom Jackson's interview with Jane Bernhardt, the Massachusetts artist, activist, and actress who co-founded the Hibakusha Peace Project. Hibakusha are survivors of the atomic bombings of Japan. Jane reads stories of Hibakusha, two poems written by them, and talks about the Peace Project. Jane traveled to Japan in 2003 and painted artistic portraits of some of the remaining Hibakusha.
Tread Lightly, Please. A poem by Junichi Mizuno, Hibakusha. This whole town by the river, where many new buildings now stand, was once, long ago, one big graveyard. Under this road, where many cars now pass, was once a little boy who crouched on the ground all day, recalling his mother who died, burned and infested with maggots. So I ask you, who now tread the streets of Hiroshima, please tread lightly. Walk with care, I beseech you, for even now many who were badly burned still lie in hospitals. Even now, suddenly, somewhere, a strange-looking person with crooked fingers hiding an irregular twitch in the face may be dying right this minute. So I ask you, all who visit this city of Hiroshima, when you walk the streets here, please tread lightly. Walk with care, I beseech you. Please.
Talking with Jane Bernhardt, activist, artist, and actress, and co-creator of the Hibakusha Peace Project. Jane traveled to Japan in 2003 and painted portraits of several of the remaining survivors of the U.S. nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The United States dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima 60 years ago today, on August 6, 1945, and it will be 60 years ago to the day on August 9th that the United States bombed Nagasaki. Jean, what inspired the Hibakusha Peace Project?
Well, in the past, as a portrait artist, I have combined sometimes my passions with my ability to capture something of the spirit of a person in a portrait. In the Cold War, I traveled to Russia and did a series of so-called enemy faces to bring us closer to the spirit of the people that were unknown to us, and we could therefore objectivize. So I was becoming increasingly upset and agitated during the latest incursions and bombings in Iraq, and suddenly began to think about the opportunities that I have had on a couple of occasions to hear the stories and meet the actual survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Once one has met these people, once one has seen their story, we can never again look at massive violence in the same way. We cannot participate in acts of genocide, acts of mass destruction. And it also occurred to me that these survivors, like the survivors of Auschwitz, so carefully chronicled by Steven Spielberg, are not any longer going to be able to travel and tell their stories. And what will our children have in the way of real, visceral remembrance? We speak rather glibly, I'm afraid to say, these days, when we speak about arsenals and megatonnage and these so-called mini-nukes, which are apparently some of them three times the size of the A-bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And so, inspired in this way, I began to think, I want to preserve a kind of spiritual living memorial through art, through creativity, and tried to contact some survivors who might be traveling in this area, and was told that actually I should really go to Hiroshima itself during the remembrance period of August 6th through 9th. And so I did travel there in 2003 and was able to meet a number of survivors and do the portraits as I was listening to their stories, which was an experience. I thought perhaps there was a way I could prepare myself for it, but there wasn't. And it's taken me a long time to begin to assimilate into my being this journey into that land of the unthinkable. These people have given the balance of their lives to saying what can't be said, to telling the stories that can't be ingested, because they are the greatest nightmare beyond what we can possibly dream or imagine. These people tread on the burned bodies of their children and their loved ones, and it's beyond endurance, and yet they endure, many of them, so that they can continue to speak over and over again the one thing that they have, which is their testimony, and their message, never again.
In the Habakusha Peace Project, when you have the portraits of individuals that you did while you were in Japan in 2003, and you tell a number of their stories, could you share one of those stories with us now?
Yes, I would be happy to share. I have several stories because in the portrait exhibit, which is a traveling exhibit, I have stories with the portraits themselves. This is the story of Suzuko Hariyama, 96 years old. I was exposed to the A-bomb at the age of 40. Even now, when I remember that day, I can't stop crying. I feel such pain in my heart. It was a living hell. I lost my son, who was in his second year of junior high school. I waited for him all night of that first day, but he never returned. Early the next morning, I started looking for my son. I tried to cross the Miyuki Bridge, but I couldn't because it was destroyed, so I kept looking. The university was still burning, and I could see that many students were dead, also horses and every other living thing. Hiroshima City was turned into a scorched land. All the schools were burned, and dead bodies were lined up in the schoolyards. I saw many people who were badly burned and crying out for water, but the water supply had been destroyed. It was terrible, terrible situation. After searching for a week, at last I found the place where my son had been taken. He was at a temple crowded with wounded survivors. My son had a severe burn on his leg, and it was covered with maggots. There was not enough medicine, and finally he died at the age of 15. Now, when I remember those days, I can't stop crying. The situation was too terrible to express. I cannot understand why such horrible weapons are produced. I do not want to see any wars in any country in the world. I don't understand why people ever start a war. Thousands of people died of A-bomb disease. I myself had been told that I would not live for more than 1 week. I don't know why I'm still alive. The A-bomb is a terrible weapon that should never be used again. I would like to read an edited version of the story told to me by Hiromu Morishita-sensei, former teacher and now executive director of the World Friendship Center. In 1945, I was 14 years old. I was a student of senior high school here in Hiroshima. August 6th began as a fine day. The sun was shining. before the explosion, but then the sun stopped. The atomic bomb went off, and I felt just like I was thrown into a big, huge fire furnace. I fell down on the ground. Already, my face was burned like a mask, peeling down. My face, my hands, my clothing were burning. If I hadn't worked to take off my clothes, maybe I would have died. About that time, I was standing on the ground with my classmates, about 50 classmates standing together. We didn't know another 69 students. We didn't know that they were dead or how they died or how they jumped or were thrown or crawled into the river. The sky was so cloudy. Then I slowly climbed up a mountain and I looked down on the city. I couldn't believe it, wondering what was happening. I felt as if I had landed in another world. At that time, I met a group of soldiers. They were young men coming towards me. All the soldiers were burned. Their hands just hung, just like ghosts, like animals. I met animals. The strangest thing had happened, but I could not know what happened. I climbed down the mountain. At first, I tried to reach my house. I tried to cross over the bridge to the place where it was, but the fire was hot, so I had to go another way. The fire was so hot. I saw so many people, dead people, burned people. The dead bodies were floating on the river just like fish. Black bodies burned. Twice I tried to cross the bridges to my home, but the flames were so hot. I couldn't cross, so I went by Hiroshima Station, burned and covered with black smoke. So many wounded people were there. I hoped to get treatment, but I couldn't get any treatment. At last, I went to my home in the evening. I found a way along the road, but I was already... My face was already swollen. My eye was closed, so I couldn't see. My hands were burned, so I walked slowly, slowly. I found my house, but already my house had burned. I can't find anything, so I hear, maybe the next day I hear from my father that my mother had died in the house, crushed. And I was wondering how I would live. I had to have surgery over and over. After a long time, I was able to go back to school, but the school was burned too, so we started a school from a barracks, but I survived. So many students and teachers had died. You ask me what message I would give to the young people of today. I believe we must talk to the young generation. The young generation must study and know the facts of war and the facts of the world situation. Why was the bomb dropped? What are the relations of the countries of the world, the reason, the history? I hope young people will learn from our experience.
Talking with Jane Bernhardt, co-creator of the Hibakusha Peace Project. I've heard you speak of we in the United States needing to, I can't remember if the exact term you used was embrace, what we did in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's interesting. I just came back from a visit with my dad in California, and my dad was on a destroyer in the Pacific in 1945, and certainly he was one of many who celebrated the end of the war and the understanding that so many Americans had that this was a necessary prevention of more loss of life. I feel that I'm not equipped to argue, although I've certainly heard many, many different opinions on why the bombs were dropped. The point is that we now are the ones who hold the greatest arsenal in the world by far, and we, in my view, hold so many nations hostage to this fear. And I think that as Americans, we are people with deep and good hearts. And what if we met a person from Hiroshima? What if we stood before them and learned of how they they saw the eaten flesh of their child, and we would weep with them, and we would want to prevent this devastation from ever happening again, and we would say, as people say when they see my exhibit, they say over and over, we're sorry. We're sorry. There's something about that act of saying, I'm sorry, that enables you to be liberated and live again. It's the strangest thing. We have grown accustomed to the hardness of heart that now shapes our international policy. And the moment of embracing some of the things that have been initiated through us as Americans, the moment of that embrace is at once painful and liberating, because we can connect at the deepest level again to what it means to be loving and human, united with all the human beings on this planet. So I say with the exhibit, if we can embrace Hiroshima, we can never again embrace the prospect of holding the world hostage to nuclear weapons.
Have you been able to keep in touch with any of the people whose portraits you did while you're in Japan?
I've been keeping in touch through the directors of the World Friendship Center. The World Friendship Center is located right near Ground Zero, and on the board of directors are a number of hibakusha. My performance piece that goes with the visual art exhibit has been reenacted there, which was very exciting for me, using copies of the pictures and the texts that I used, and even a woman played koto when I described that music in the course of a performance piece, which we now have. And also, when people come to the exhibit, they are invited to write messages which are returned to Hiroshima. So there's a little earthen vessel, and people can put their messages into it. And the first 100 I gave to the mayor, Mayor Akiba of Hiroshima. And the second 100 were enlarged and taken to one of the nursing homes, one of the three nursing homes for A-bomb survivors that are in the perimeters of the city. So I feel that there's a connection, even though I haven't been personally emailing one or two of the survivors. They're very much aware of the program.
And speaking of the program, you have a performance coming up tomorrow at South Church in Boston. You want to tell us a little about that?
That's right. It's actually 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There are going to be many, many wonderful events. There are different places where bells will be chimed and movies will be shown. And at Old South Church at Copley Square at 11 o'clock, there'll be a very special church service, including Japanese chorus and peace cranes and remembrances of various sorts. And then at 2 o'clock, people are invited to come and witness, participate in the exhibit and also our performance piece, which includes original music by Greta Bro and Peter Mayer, beautiful dancing by a Japanese performer named Minori Ishikawa, a wonderful cellist by the name of Daniel Rowe. And then, for the first time, we have two wonderful Nepalese dancers performing as our kroko, our invisible people who will be moving things around on the stage, Sundar Garung and his dance partner, Junu. So it's going to be very beautiful, and we invite people to come. There'll be poetry and dance and an opportunity for remembrance and transformation.
And so that's coming up tomorrow afternoon, August 7th, at 2 o'clock at the South Church in Boston, 645 Boylston Street. Does the Hibakusha Peace Project have a website?
Yes. People may go to janebernhardt.com. That's Jane, spelled the usual way, Bernhardt, B-E-R-N-H-A-R-D-T, no space, .com. And click on Performance, click on Hibakusha Peace Project. There also is the opportunity to order beautiful full-color gicle prints of the pieces in the exhibit, and I welcome anyone contacting me for future exhibits and performances, and that information is also on the website. I would like to actually end, if I might, with another poem. This is a poem written by a survivor, and it's called Mourning, a poem by Sankichi Toga. They dream. A workman dreams, lowering his pickaxe, with sweat in scars from the blast. A housewife dreams, bending over her sewing machine with sederia reeking from her slipped skin. A box office girl dreams, her feet curled like a crab's. A match seller also dreams, with shattered glass still fast in her neck. Thus they dream, by an everlasting division of energy, that famished deserts shall be turned into fertile fields, and bright canals run round the feet of crumbling mountains, that cities and towns shall be built of pure gold. Thus they dream, in the shade of trees where festival flags are waving, and working people take their rest, that the legends of Hiroshima may be told by their tender lips. Thus they dream that those swine in men's shape who knew not how to harness the energy from Earth's center except for slaughter may survive only in picture books for the little ones, and that the energy of 10 million horsepower per gram may be released out of the atom into the hands of the people, and that the rich crop of science may be shared in peace among nations, and like bunches of abundant grapes wet with dew may be gathered in at dawn.
Jane Bernhardt, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
It's a great pleasure and an honor on this 60th anniversary. Thank you.
If you would like to see and hear Jane perform, you can do that this Sunday, tomorrow, August 7th. It's Peace Sunday at Old South Church at 645 Boylston Street, Copley Square, Boston. At 11 a.m., there's a worship service that will feature the New England Peace Pagoda, and then at 2 p.m., the Hibakusha Peace Project performance featuring Jane Bernhardt and friends. For more information, contact 617-425-5153. And now for a song that barely needs introduction, John Lennon with Imagine. You're listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice on WSCA LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. And now for Between the Lines, Independent Radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Cavanna of the Institute for Policy Studies, who takes a critical look at congressional passage of the Central America Free Trade Agreement and what it may mean for workers on both sides of the border. Tyson Slocum with Public Citizens Energy Program, who discusses the billions of dollars in subsidies and deregulation provisions granted to the energy industry in the recently passed energy bill. And Stanley Aronowitz, professor of sociology and author, who examines the possible consequences of the split within the AFL-CIO and the future of the American labor movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Violence flared up in late July for the first time in 6 months in the conflict-ridden Darfur region of Sudan. The rebel Sudanese Liberation Movement told the French AFP press agency that 4 villages were bombed by the Sudanese army. In response, an army spokesman said they only attacked rebel camps after a civilian convoy was hit. Meanwhile, Sally Booker, director of the group Africa Action, complained that the U.S. Congress has failed to provide effective action to stop the bloodshed in Darfur since it passed a resolution stating genocide was being committed there. The death of newly appointed Sudanese vice president and former rebel leader John Garang in a helicopter crash in southern Sudan puts the North-South peace process in doubt. In the U.S., anti-genocide activists are putting the heat on American TV networks to increase the amount of coverage to the Darfur crisis, where 2.3 million people were forced from their homes and live in camps for displaced persons and refugees. According to the Tyndall Report, which tracks network news coverage, ABC, CBS, and NBC aired only 26 minutes of coverage of the Darfur crisis in 2004. In contrast, the networks gave the legal troubles of domestic diva Martha Stewart 130 minutes of broadcast news coverage during the same period. The growing wave of violence in Haiti has claimed the life of journalist Jacques Roche. His body was found on July 14th, bound, mutilated, and shot several times. Roche, the cultural editor of Le Martin newspaper, was kidnapped 5 days earlier, and some of his friends had negotiated with his abductors. According to Reuters, more than 450 Haitians have been kidnapped since March, but Roche is only the fourth to be killed. Roche hosted a TV program on civic issues for the Group of 184, the coalition of conservative business, religious, and civic leaders that pushed for the 2004 removal of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. In recent days, police arrested Reverend Gerard Jean-Just, a prominent Aristide supporter, in connection with the killing. The Catholic priest had earlier gone to Roche's funeral, creating a near riot by anti-Aristide forces. Jean-Just was in Florida at the time when the journalist was kidnapped and murdered. Amnesty International has declared Father Jean-Just a prisoner of conscience, arbitrarily arrested by the U.S.-installed government, like dozens of other Aristide supporters in Haiti. Under U.S. pressure, United Nations peacekeepers have increased its presence in neighborhoods loyal to Aristide. On July 6th, UN troops raided the Cité Soleil district. The UN says 5 people were killed in the raid. Outside observers say dozens were killed. 30 years ago, Pakistani nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan stole vital nuclear secrets while working as a contractor for Urenco, a European-based conglomerate. Over the years, Khan used these stolen secrets to establish Pakistan's nuclear program and developed a black market network for nuclear technology with links to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. Today, Khan remains under house arrest in Pakistan, yet the company Urenco, with the powerful backing of U.S. Senator Peter Domenici of New Mexico, is slated to build a new $1.2 billion uranium enrichment plant in Hobbs, New Mexico. According to Sierra Magazine, its design is similar to the controversial Iranian centrifuge plant. This project also comes at a time when the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is calling for a 5-year moratorium on building new uranium enrichment plants. Yet environmentalists and some local residents are worried about proliferation. Rose Gardner of neighboring Eunice, New Mexico, complained, "Homeland Security is constantly talking to us about being prepared. Be ready. Yet my town is welcoming a company that processes the very technology that the terrorists want." The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which must license the plant, has used security concerns to restrict public access to key sections of the plant's application. Among the related sections, says Don Hancock of the Southwest Research and Information Center, is the possible health hazard of a rail accident involving a shipment of radioactive waste. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
By the narrowest of margins, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Central America Free Trade Agreement in the early hours of July 28th. The hard-fought battle saw last-minute shifts among many legislators whose votes were sought by an aggressive White House wielding threats and rewards. The victory was secured after Republicans extended the usual 15 minutes of voting time to over an hour for the purpose of pressuring wavering representatives. In the end, 15 Democrats supported CAFTA, while 27 Republicans bucked their party by opposing the trade treaty. The controversial Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, will eliminate trade barriers between the U.S., Costa Rica, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Critics fear that, like the North America Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, that came into force in 1994, CAFTA will accelerate the loss of U.S. jobs, devastate small farmers, and encourage the proliferation of sweatshops. Over the last decade, NAFTA has been blamed for the loss of 1 million American jobs and 1.5 million Mexican farmers being driven off their land. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Cavanna, director of the Institute for Policy Studies. He takes a critical look at congressional passage of the Central America Free Trade Agreement and what it may mean for workers on both sides of the border.
This is another one of these trade agreements that Republicans love and that corporations love. Basically, it's important for your listeners to know these are agreements, even though the title sounds great, free trade, they're basically agreements that give a lot of new rights to large corporations with no new responsibilities. In essence, it allows the Ford Motor Company to shift plants across the border freely. It allows it to shift goods back and forth without paying any tariffs. It gives protections for goods, U.S. goods like cassette CDs, DVDs from being pirated. So it's a whole bunch of protections. It's kind of goodie bag for corporations. And yet, as many of us and many of the critics and trade unions and environmental groups have been saying, it doesn't impose any new responsibilities on these firms to take care of worker rights or pay attention to the environment. What just passed last week is a smaller version of NAFTA. It's a version that will now free up trade and investment and corporate rights between the United States and the countries of Central America and one nation in the Caribbean, the Dominican Republic. Everybody should be clear, this is less of a disaster than NAFTA in that these are small economies. There isn't that much trade and investment between the United States and these countries, although there is some. It's where a lot of textile and apparel companies have gone because of cheap exploited labor. And it's also, these are countries that send a lot of sugar into the United States. So there is a fear of job loss, and there is a fear also that there are no environmental protections. One more word. This is why it was only a Pyrrhic victory for the Republicans. They only won it. It was a vote in the House of Representatives. They won it 217 to 215. I actually don't remember a closer vote on any issue. The Bush administration could only pass it, could only win it by buying a number of key votes of Republicans, offering these members deals that would be good for them and their districts at the last minute to buy their vote. So it was only by purchasing democracy, if you will, that they got the thing through.
What do you think this trade agreement means for the people of Central America? Do you expect that we're going to see a lot of maquiladora-type factories opening up or other kinds of economic activity moving north to south?
Yeah, exactly. You already have in countries like El Salvador and Honduras, a lot of sweatshops that make apparel. This will speed it up. This will also speed up the shift of sugar production from sugar beets, which are grown in the U.S., to sugar cane in countries like the Dominican Republic. So it will amount to some job shifting, some job loss, which is going on anyway. It accelerates it. So rather than the U.S. government doing what it should, which is putting in place protections for workers, protections for the environment, disincentives to companies to shift production overseas, they've just passed another set of incentives that are good for corporations and bad for everybody else. I mean, in Central America, George Bush was trying to argue it's great for people in Central America. Well, in fact, these are lousy jobs. These are the same sort of sweatshop jobs that we saw here in the United States 100 years ago, and which aren't good jobs, which don't lead to development, which lead to poverty and immiseration, and go against the struggle for basic rights for all people that are central to the democratic struggles of today.
Now, as we close out here, John, I wanted to ask you about the next fight ahead. As I understand it, the free trade area of the Americas agreement, which is under negotiation, is all but dead, given the many governments that have emerged in Latin America that vehemently oppose the conditions the United States wants to set up in that hemispheric-wide free trade agreement. What do you expect to happen with FTAA and other free trade fights in the near to not too distant future?
There will be now an effort by the United States government to rekindle talks and to negotiate something. And I think given that there is opposition, as you've laid out, in the democracies, the countries that have elected governments skeptical of free trade in Brazil and Argentina and Uruguay and Venezuela, I think what the United States will try to do is pick off other countries and come up with a version of a free trade agreement of the Americas that includes other countries that would be willing to join into the free trade model. This will create a huge fight within Latin America, and there is a certain amount of solidarity among Latin American countries, and I don't think it's going to work. It'll be a big fight, but I think that's winnable. And then the second fight is on the global stage. There is a global NAFTA, if you will, called the World Trade Organization. The U.S. government is trying to give it more powers, strengthen it, enlarge it, give it greater powers to protect corporations. And there will be a big meeting in Hong Kong in December where citizen groups and some developing country governments will band together to try to block that agenda.
That was John Cavanna, director of the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. An industry-friendly energy bill was one of the first pieces of legislation put forward by the Bush administration shortly after taking office in early 2001. But the legislation was mired in controversy as lawsuits by conservative and liberal groups sought access to information about secret meetings to formulate the measure Vice President Dick Cheney had held with executives from the energy industry such as Enron. Every year for the past 4 years, Congress adjourned without passing energy legislation. But just before heading home for this year's August recess, the House and Senate reconciled different versions of the energy bill each chamber had passed in the spring. Opening Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, to oil drilling was not included in the final version of this energy bill, but the Senate had provided such authorization in an unrelated budget bill. So drilling for oil in the Arctic that would at most cover 6 months of U.S. consumption is still on the table. The energy bill gives billions of dollars in subsidies to profitable industries and deregulates the energy industry by repealing one of the strongest consumer and investor protection laws, the Public Utility Holding Company Act. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Tyson Slocum, research director with Public Citizens Energy Program, a consumer advocacy group in Washington, D.C. He assesses the bill and what he views as the measure's few positive provisions, along with its many negative aspects.
The Public Utility Holding Company Act imposes strong regulations over the electric utility industry because it recognizes that electric utility companies in the industry is very unique within the American economy, and so it really needs extra layers of protection for consumers and investors. And what the energy bill does is that it removes these protections. And the first thing that this will result in is a wave of new mergers where lots of other utilities will be acquiring other utilities. But more importantly, different types of companies will now be owning utilities. Now, for the first time, investment banks like Goldman Sachs, insurance companies like John Hancock, and even oil companies like ExxonMobil can now buy utilities. And this will be a very negative thing for consumers because these entities are interested in the guaranteed revenues that electric utilities generate from their captive ratepayers. And so they're going to be more interested in getting their hands on that guaranteed money rather than reinvesting their profits back into reliability and discounts for consumers.
Does the bill make it more or less likely that the U.S. will see another massive blackout such as we had across the East a few years ago?
The energy bill actually does partially address some of the causes of the blackout, and that is the energy bill now will have enforceable mandatory reliability standards where utilities are going to have reliability standards. So in that sense, that's a positive thing, one of the very few positive things in the energy bill. However, the other main contributing factor to the blackout of 2003 was deregulation. In that sense, the energy bill is going to make matters worse because it's going to encourage further deregulation by repealing the Public Utility Holding Company Act, among other things.
How do subsidies for the oil, coal, gas, and nuclear industries in this bill compare with the subsidies for renewable energy?
The energy bill has about $20 billion in tax breaks for energy. 65% of that, or almost $13 billion, is going to oil companies, to coal companies, and for nuclear power. So it's clear that the energy bill is disproportionately benefits dirty and dangerous fuel sources. And that's just ridiculous. You know, ExxonMobil has enjoyed profits of $80 billion since 2001, and yet they and their other oil companies are slated to receive hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in tax breaks. That doesn't make sense from energy policy perspective or from a fiscal policy perspective. The largest five oil companies operating in the United States have enjoyed after-tax profits of $230 billion since 2001. That's because oil prices and gasoline prices are at record highs.
What about nuclear power?
This energy bill greatly escalates the level of subsidies to the nuclear power industry. In fact, it will be providing subsidies at every stage of production. And there's lots of financial incentives to build new nuclear power plants.
And what about renewable energy?
There's about over $3 billion for renewable energy, except some of that renewable energy is going to be included for burning garbage and things like that that aren't really renewable or clean. But it does increase money for wind and solar and hydrogen and other clean renewable energy. It does have some limited energy efficiency measures. It provides some added incentives to homeowners and small businesses to improve the energy efficiency of their homes. And it includes small tax incentives to manufacturers to encourage them to produce more energy-efficient appliances like refrigerators and dishwashers and washing machines.
Does the bill include any significant effort to reduce energy consumption?
Every day, the United States uses 25% of the world's oil. But the energy bill does nothing to address rising rates of oil consumption in America. The best way to reduce oil consumption is to improve fuel economy standards in our cars and trucks. But the energy bill, both the House and the Senate, explicitly rejected efforts to improve fuel economy. There was a lot of sensible policies that were rejected during the energy bill debate, and it really comes down to the power of wealthy special interests. That's why we have an energy bill that further deregulates, that'll bring us more Enrons, that will actually contribute to global warming. It will make oil more expensive in this country, and all it does is shower some of the biggest companies in America with huge tax breaks and subsidies.
That was Tyson Slocum of Public Citizens Energy Program. Contact Public Citizen at area code 202-588-1000 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. Just before July's AFL-CIO National Convention got underway in Chicago, Andy Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union, declared that both the SEIU and Teamsters Union are leaving the nation's primary union federation. The announcement came after 2 years of warnings from Stern and several other union presidents that a split was inevitable unless the AFL-CIO devoted more resources to organizing and undertook other major reforms. The Federation's president, John Sweeney, who was a mentor to Stern when both men were at the SEIU, charged that the split was motivated by a power grab rather than substantive divisions over policy. Sweeney warned that the split will undermine labor solidarity when it is needed most to combat the anti-union policies of President Bush and the GOP-controlled Congress. Stern, founder of the new Change to Win labor coalition, insists that dramatic restructuring is necessary if unions are to reverse decades of membership losses. Two other large unions may join the SEIU and Teamsters in bolting the AFL-CIO, which could reduce the Federation's 13 million members by up to 5 million. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stanley Aronowitz, professor of sociology at the City University of New York and author of more than 20 books on labor and economic issues. Aronowitz examines the possible consequences of the split within the AFL-CIO and the future of the American labor movement.
A split right now in the AFL-CIO cannot but help the forward march of the labor movement, if only because competition is really, in many ways, the only way that unions can get off the dime. The AFL-CIO has a bylaw which says that there can be no raiding. It tries to strictly control its member unions in their organizing strategy so that turf wars cannot take place. But in many ways, the unions have always prospered because of chaos. I use the word chaos very deliberately because I think competition, chaos, the unpredictability will help unions. But there are two issues that have to be put into play here. And the first one is that Stern and his colleagues, especially James Hoffa, the president of the Teamsters Union, have said, look, the Sweeney team is really trying to divert a lot of money into politics, that is, to support the Democratic Party. And Hoffa said, don't throw money at the Democrats. Spend the money by giving it to the affiliates and letting them organize the unorganized. And I think that's a very important part of what's going on. I think the Stern team, in this instance, wants to focus on organizing rather than on politics, and especially the politics of a very centrist and a very gloomy Democratic Party, at least on a national scale. The second thing that is very important here, and Robert Fitch has just written a piece that I think is worthy of repeating, he says that the old unions represent the most stable, in many ways, the highest paid of the labor force, public employees, building trades, industrial workers who still have their jobs, who are making decent money, have most of their benefits are still intact. The new groups, with the exception of some sections of the Teamsters, the new groups that want to break away are people who are trying to organize the working poor, are trying to organize people who are not making it, who are working in casual and in many ways substandard jobs with no benefits often and very low wages. So, by and large, the unions are still on a downward spiral, and despite the gains that the service employees have made, I think they still don't have a serious clue as to how to really revive the labor movement.
What about the criticism, Stanley Aronowitz, that in the face of a president who's very hostile towards the labor movement and a House of Representatives and Senate dominated by Republicans with a similar agenda, anti-union agenda, that a split in the AFL-CIO at this time is very dangerous and foolhardy? What do you think?
Well, I don't think that the reasons for the split are necessarily substantial enough to justify it, although I think it might help the unions. The problem with that argument that you just gave me, Scott, is that the unions were declining under the Clinton administration, the unions were declining under the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, Bush 1, and the unions were declining under the Carter administration. The decline is not because of the Bush administration, that is George W. Bush. The decline is because over the long term, unions have been hit by three major problems. One is globalization. Two is technological change. And three is the internal rot, the bureaucratic rot that most of these unions suffer. They don't have the confidence of their membership. Workers don't think they can be protected in the course of organizing by the unions. The unions don't raise their voices in the ways that they need to raise their voices against the terrible assault on wages and working conditions that large corporations and the government has been undertaking, I think, now for at least 30 years.
Stanley Aronowitz, in your recent article on the future of American labor written before the split occurred within the AFL-CIO, you make the argument that a fire has to be lit under labor across this country to transform it from a mere business unionism to more of something of a vibrant, exciting movement where it's a real cause for people to get involved, and that maybe including hundreds of thousands of people who are not, you know, workplace union members, but maybe involved in unionism and labor as a social change movement.
Unions today cannot transform themselves from within, not only because they lack the vision of what a better life would be, but because they lack the confidence in workers themselves to make the changes that are necessary. I believe that radical forces like the industrial workers of the world, like the communists and the socialists and the other radicals of the 1930s, like the feminists of the 1960s and black freedom movement people, civil rights people who transformed the public employees unions from sleepy time organizations into vibrant large-scale organizations, that we need some kind of movement in some sense that is not within the trade unions themselves to light a fire under the unions and to mobilize people regardless of whether they're going to get a contract or not. I use the example in the article that you referred to of the Trade Union Education League, which was a radical organization in the late 1920s and early 1930s, which really did lit a fire. How it's going to happen, we don't have time to discuss. But I do think that it's not going to happen because Andy Stern or Jim Hoffa or John Sweeney makes pronouncements about the necessity to organize the unorganized.
That was Stanley Aronowitz, professor of sociology at the City University of New York and author of more than 20 books on labor and economic issues. Visit his website at www.stanleyaronowitz.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Top. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks to Between the Lines. And now, Bless Our Planet by Shauna Carroll.
Bless your blue-green ocean, bless your endless skies, streams and your valleys, your mountains so high. Bless your gods and goddesses, Buddha, Sikh, and Jain. Jesus, Allah, Yemaya, we 1,000 languages, we speak with the same tongue. Love's a planet under one sky. All the people on it, we all laugh and we all cry. Oh, bless our planet, place of our birth. We are all one family, we're children of the earth. Bless your vibrant city, bless your sacred ground, hillsides and forests, and bless your tiny town. Bless the winged ones that fly, bless the horse and bear, elephant, the dolphin, the cricket and the hare. Speak 1,000 languages, we speak with the same tongue.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Marowitz, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and hoping for your membership and participation. To join and learn more, contact the station at 430-WSCA. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be continuing with our commemoration of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we'll address the possibility of creating a non-nuclear future in the world and in Portsmouth. We leave you with this quote by Thomas Edison. "There will one day spring from the brain of science a machine or force so fearful in its potentialities, so absolutely terrifying, that even man, the fighter, who will dare torture death in order to inflict torture and death, will be appalled, and so abandon war forever."